Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to a brand new Arseblog Arsecast right here on arseblog.com. How are you? Hope you're well. We're recording this not long after the triumphant, glorious victory in the Europa League over Karabag in Azerbaijan. Their manager suggested that we might be afraid, too scared to bring Henrik Mkhitaryan because of the political situation between Azerbaijan and Armenia. The former Borussia Dortmund man decided to sit this one out, probably quite sensibly, but their coach, whose name is something like Gurban Gurbanov or Gobov Gobabov, Goblov Globatov, whatever his name is, we weren't afraid. There was nothing fragiler about the way that we made that decision. We didn't need Henrik Mkhitaryan. Why would we need Henrik Mkhitaryan when we've got Emile Smith-Rowe? Yeah, that's right. You go on and try and make your political points and big up yourself in front of your Azerbaijani mates, sticking it to the Armenian who didn't even make the journey. And you forget all about the blonde-haired English wonder kid who scored the second goal between your goalkeeper's legs. How about that, Globrov-Blovanov? You never even considered the possibility that this young man would deal your side a devastating blow at a time in the game, in fairness, where they were playing pretty well. You might even say that the goal came against the run of play. And just when Graboslav Grabanov Grobolov Grobolar thought that his team was getting back into it, there was the young man playing in the position that probably Henrik Mkhitaryan would have played in, to get on the end of a lovely pass from Alex Iwobi and to drill the ball between the legs of the goalkeeper to make it 2-0. And after that, the momentum changed, the game kind of swung in our favour, and you can be quite sure that back in London, Henrik Mkhitaryan was sitting there in front of his gigantic TV. It's probably a 4K. Footballers have probably got 8K or 16K. They just don't tell us mortal folks about these things. You know, it's like the Nando's black card shit. They get all the good stuff for free, even though they can afford it. Not that I'm saying Nando's is good, by the way. I just want to make that very clear. It's not good. It's bad. I know many of you out there probably like Nando's, but I'm sorry. I had it once and it was like, ugh. Anyway, the point I'm making is that Henrik Mkhitaryan was sitting there in front of his gigantic TV with the words of blah, 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 ringing around in his ears, and he'll have thought, ha, see you for the return game in London, pal, when I might even possibly play. Or not, it depends. Maybe Emile Smith-Rowe will keep his place, but it doesn't really matter. Justice is, well, this isn't justice. It was a completely different player scoring. But I think Mkhitaryan would have enjoyed it. That's what I'm trying to get across here. Henrik Mkhitaryan would have enjoyed that goal. And I think we should all enjoy that goal. A young man who's made the breakthrough from the Haaland Academy, shone in pre-season, has been given some chances, and wow, I thought he was really, really impressive against Karabag last night. I know it's tonight when I'm recording. Just, you know, pretend as if it's live or whatever. But I thought he was really, really good. Some beautiful turns, some nice passing, some good dribbling. I think we could have a player on our hands here, folks. I don't want to hype him up too early, but I like what I see from Emile Smith-Rowe, and I was delighted to see him score, and obviously delighted for the other two goal scorers as well. Socrates, he gets his first Arsenal goal, bundling home with his, I think probably his right nipple. Monreal headed the ball across and he just deflected it in with a mighty pectoral muscle and a little flick of his nip. And then late on, Matteo Guendouzi scoring his first Arsenal goal, set up by Alexandre Lacazette. Quick feet on the edge of the box, and he put it past the keeper, who maybe should have done better. But you can't argue with a 3-0 result away from home in the Europa League. Apparently, this was the furthest we have ever travelled for a European game. Ever. We've gone far and we've gone farther, and this is farthest, the farthest we have ever gone for a European game, to Azerbaijan, to Baku, and we've come away with 3 points. And I think there's some things to talk about. So what I'm going to do is bring in our guest now, just to tell you, in a few minutes after we talk to this particular guest, I'm going to talk to somebody else, because recently we had the news that Ivan Gazidis is leaving the club. He's going to leave at the end of October. Just a little space there for you to silently weep to yourself. It's going to be emotional, I know. But head of football relations, Raul Sanyehi, will become head of football. He will have greater responsibility. So I wanted to talk to somebody about him who can tell us a bit about what he did at Barcelona, for example. So I'm going to talk to Dan Hilton, who's the host of the Barcelona podcast and also part of the Barca blog team. We're going to talk Raul Sanyehi a little bit later in the show. But right now, to talk Europa League, 3-0 win over Karabag and all the rest, it is the man from East Lower. Hello to you.
Hello.
Oh, hello. I just want to ask you, just very briefly, before we get into this this discussion about Arsenal, which of the Karabag players stood out most for you last night?
I think it was probably one of the ones in the dark coloured shirts.
No,
probably one of those.
The names. Was it the guy whose name ended in V or Z, or which guy?
I think there was one who really stuck out on the... He was the one that was going through the middle, and sometimes he ended in, maybe he was called Pavlov.
Pavlov, yeah. I believe he's got a number of dogs.
he does, but they weren't on the pitch.
No, sadly. We could do with some dogs on the pitch, perhaps, for some entertainment. But, okay, look, we won 3-0 away from home in a Europa League away clash. On the surface, on the face of it, you know, there's not a lot you can argue with when it comes to the result.
No, 3-0, and continuing our nice little run, it was pretty comfortable with a few sort of hairy moments, but I think you have to look at these things through the prism of the Europa League, which is, as we know, because it's our second season in it, is a strange competition at this stage. So but I think we did all we needed to do. I mean, that's pretty much how it panned out.
Do you not harbour any concerns that one of the themes, and I will talk about the good things, I promise, but one of the common themes of this season has been the amount of chances that we have offered up to the opposition, and I think offered up is probably a good way to put it, because we found ourselves exposed and we've allowed the opposition to get in behind us. Is this still a group of players trying to figure out what it is that Unai Emery wants? Is it Unai Emery trying to figure out how to get these players to defend? You know, I think Bernd Leno made at least two, maybe three really good saves in this particular game, at times when a goal conceded would have changed the complexion of what was going on.
Yeah, I don't think it was a problem of individuals. It wasn't your main man, Skodran, who you love so very much. I don't think what we saw were any sort of calamitous individual errors. I think actually, if you look through the back line, there were some good performances in there. I think, as you say, Leno did really well, very well. And I thought Holding was good. I thought Socrates was really good. I thought Klasinac was a bit rusty, but it got a bit better as the game went on. But overall, I don't think there was anything, there were no standout weak players there, but I just think, like you said, it's more about what's he trying to do with this defense. Where's he trying to take them? And I don't think they're there yet. And I think at some point, maybe this time next season or in the summer, he'll start discarding a few and getting a few in, and that's when you'll start seeing what he really wants to do. Because at the moment, it feels like he's still not quite sure you know, what's going on there. So, yeah, I don't think it was a people thing. It's more of a structure and what he wants, and I don't think anybody quite knows that yet.
Yeah, I mean, he started with a three at the back, which was interesting because he has been wedded to this 4-2-3-1 formation throughout the season, and then we go away from home against a team like Qarabağ, who, with all due respect, you would back us to impose our game on. You know, this was only his 10th game in charge, Unai Emery. You know, was this about him showing his tactical flexibility? Was it, you know, a system designed to negate the qualities of Qarabağ based on the scouting that he's had? You know, I found just the change in formation a little bit strange.
I'm not sure I did, really, because I think if you're going to try something, and he needs to try lots of different things to see what clicks, if anything. But I think if you're going to try it, you try it on a game like this when, you know, we won the first group stage game. We should get through the group. And, you know, I think it's, you know, he's going to left a few players behind and or on the bench to give them a rest. I think it's almost the perfect time to try something a bit different. I mean, I think he obviously did change it up after a while, but I thought it was a relatively risk-free time. As you say, with the greatest respect to Qarabağ, it was fairly risk-free time to try something a bit different.
Mm. Half-time change again. What's your feeling on those?
I'm starting to really yearn the 68-minute change. I don't know. I quite admire it in a way. I think, you know, he's going to try it for a half, doesn't work, try something else. And I just think, you know, the big picture for me is that it was his 10th game, like you said, and 10 games is nothing, right? So he's just fiddling around the edges, trying to get a bit of a better picture of how it all is. And if that means half-time changes, so be it. You know, if I was going to stick my neck out, I'd say probably you'll find there are fewer half-time changes towards the end of the season once he knows what's going on. But, you know, we are always quick to judge, and 10 games in is really nothing. He's just juggling stuff around until he works out what's best.
Mm. Okay, I mean, that's fair enough. It's a very sanguine approach to analysis of a football game. But that's, you know, I'm okay with it.
It's a bit like when people, after three games of the season, look at the league table and start, you know, saying, oh, my God, we're in trouble. Think, no, just give it a time. It is too early, even now, to make any sort of definitive judgments, other than we're still not defending that well, but we're winning. So, yeah. You know, I think these things will settle down once he's had a bit more under his belt, and then we'll start to see whether it's, you know, we'll start to see whether it's a personnel thing, a structural thing, or whether Emery's just not quite getting it right, all those kind of things. I just don't think we know yet.
Yeah, that's fair. I mean, I just, you know, harbour some concerns that if we give up those kind of chances to better teams, we might just end up on the wrong end of a very difficult result. But look, we'll cross that bridge when we come to it, because it is 8 wins out of 8. I think they said on BT tonight that it's maybe over 3 years or more than 3 years. I can't remember. Maybe I just made that up, but I think they said something like that. It's over 3 years since we won 8 games in a row in all competitions. So that really is the positive thing. You know, if you want to flip it around, we're not playing that well. We are offering up a lot of chances, but we're winning games. And actually, I suppose if we talk about playing well, if a striker is scoring lots of goals, we'll say, well, this is great, we're getting the best out of this striker, and the striker is doing his job to great effect. What we've seen, I think, this season is that our goalkeepers are playing very well. So you can look at that two ways. One is, like, don't make your goalkeepers that busy. But the other side of that is, if your goalkeeper is that busy, it's probably better that they're capable of making the saves that we've seen Petr Cech make. And in the last couple of games, Bernd Leno has made important saves. He made important saves in the game against Watford, and I think he made very important saves in the game against Qarabağ last night.
Yeah, I think he made three very, you know, good saves. Not well, sort of world class, but all good saves. And you know, it's fascinating in a way, because all those rumours that were coming out of London Colney about how he wasn't all that. You know, he wasn't all that, Emery I'm talking about here, you know, wasn't liking what he saw, and so he was being, Leno was being held back. But from what I've seen in the last two or three games, that doesn't really ring true with me. I wouldn't be at all surprised if he held him back to kind of inspire a bit of competition and to get him, you know, fired up a bit, because I think everyone from time to time needs a bit of, you know, kick up the arse. And maybe it was as simple as that. He thought, you know, he'll be coming in at some point, let's make him hungry. Yeah. He certainly looked very good in the last couple of games. So, unless he, unless this is unusual, which I very much doubt, because he's played a hell of a lot of games for his previous club, then I think we've got a good keeper on our hands.
Yeah, well, I hope so. And the actual the competitive environment that he has created by picking Petr Cech and going with the experience and leaving a £22.5 million signing on the bench, which is not what most managers do. Certainly, it's not something that Arsenal do, is spend that much money on a player and then leave him on the bench. You know, maybe that's part of his thinking. It's fostered this competitive environment to keep Petr Cech on his toes, which has worked. And when Bernd Leno has come in, he knows he's got to play well to keep his place, to take his chance, and he's done that.
I think so, yeah. I mean, I think you could really argue that's exactly why he held him back. But, we're not privy to what goes on behind the scenes. But certainly nothing I've seen about Leno since he's started playing has been anything other than pretty positive.
We hope he can keep that up, obviously, going forward, because we do have more tricky fixtures coming up in the next few weeks. Fulham on Sunday, we might touch on that a little bit later on. But one of the other big positives of the night was Emile Smith-Rowe. And if it were Arsene Wenger who had given Emile Smith-Rowe his first starts and got a goal out of him on his third game for the club, it would be another, Arsene Wenger does it again. And I suppose we have to give credit to the Wenger structure for bringing through somebody like Smith-Rowe. But he really does look like an exciting talent, doesn't he?
He does. He looks strong and he looks like he likes to run at people, which is partly a sort of an indication of his youth, but also he does look good. And he made a couple of nice things and spun around a few times. And then of course the goal was very, very well taken. I don't think he can be, if he gets 15 games, as a sub or something this season, I'd say anyone would say that's a pretty decent return for someone that age. And, I think what you don't want to do is do, in a way, what happened with maybe Wilshere and Fabregas, although they were ready at that age. But, I think it takes a lot out of you at that age. So maybe holding him back a bit, edging him in like this is the best way of doing it.
Mm. And it is good, I suppose, to see young players coming through the academy and being given a chance and proving that, the transfer market is something that captures the imagination of everybody, because who doesn't like a new signing? When you buy a new player, everybody is like completely invested in this guy. They want him to be good. They love a transfer. All of us included, I think here, there's something exciting about it. But when it happens a bit more organically, when it's a young guy who's been at the club since the age of 8 or 9 or 10 or whatever it is, there's something a bit different about it.
I think so. And the fact he's British as well, really, I think it adds a little something to it, because everyone likes to see a local lad come through. Mm. I think people are often prepared to overlook sometimes other things that maybe they wouldn't overlook in other players that age just because they're local. But I think he's done all he can. And, if you look back at some of the players we had, like people like Kieran Gibbs and Oxlade-Chamberlain and all those players, and Walcott, when he was younger, we did sort of cut them quite a lot of slack in their early days because they were, because they were British, or maybe we do it for everyone. It just feels like, I think people will the local lads on a little bit more because it's an English club, and to bring English players through is a nice thing.
Yeah, well, speaking of local lads, somebody else who has had a really good season so far, and I thought he was very good against Carabag as well, is Alex Iwobi, who doesn't seem to necessarily get it in the same way. I know that he declared for Nigeria, obviously, because of his family, but he represented England at under 17, many youth levels until about under 17, then they completely ignored him, so he went for Nigeria. But it's overlooked, perhaps, that he's the same as Smith-Rowe, he's the same as Wilshere. He came through from a really, really early age at Arsenal. He joined at 8 or 9 years of age. He's come through the grade, come through all the academies. He's gone through a really difficult period in his career as well. When he burst on the scene, he was played in the Camp Nou against Barcelona. He was really exciting. He added something new and a bit different to a team that needed it at that point, that was maybe a little bit stale with somebody like Theo Walcott in it. And then found it a bit of a struggle, you know, and he's not the only one, in fairness, who has found developing as a young player a bit of a struggle, particularly in the final years of Arsene Wenger's reign. But he seems to be thriving under Unai Emery, and the perhaps he what's interesting to me, actually, is he spoke about freedom, and he's playing with freedom, and he's performing with freedom. And that's sort of a thing that you would expect Arsene Wenger to grant a player, whereas Unai Emery, you might think he's got bigger structures or more rigid structures in which a player must operate, but perhaps being within certain confines allows him to play in the way that he's playing.
Well, that's right. I suppose, you know, you kind of ask yourself, what is playing with freedom? You know, how do you define that? Maybe the freedom he feels is because he knows what he's doing. He's definitely made a big improvement this season. And I suppose if you're going to look at, sometimes it's, I think you guys have spoken about it before tons on the previous podcast this season, but sometimes it's hard to kind of know where Emery's making, you know, what the really big differences are. But with a player like him, you can say he's definitely better than he was last season. And something's changed there. And it's great. It is great to see. He's been, again, very direct. He's creating goals, like still sometimes holds onto the ball a bit too long, but you know, I still think overall he's been very, very positive player, and he's definitely knocking on the starting 11 now, I think, which is great. It's great for him. And yeah, you're right, he's another local lad, so it's quite exciting when you get two of them in the same team, you know, passing to one another and scoring.
Yeah, and we've also got Hector Bellerin. I know he came from Barcelona, but he came at 15, 16 years of age. He's 23 now, so he's 7-8 years nearly with Arsenal, and that's you know, I think having those players who've come through the ranks and who understand what the club is about really is an important thing. I was curious as to your take on the strength of the squad that Emery brought to Azerbaijan. It's a long trip. It's 5.5 hours each way. And he's brought Mesut Ozil, and he put Mesut Ozil on. He brought Alexandre Lacazette, and he put Lacazette on. People are looking at the game against Fulham on Sunday at noon and saying, well, maybe we should rest players a bit more. But it just strikes me that the fact that he put Ozil on, he put Lacazette on, maybe he's a man who looks at continuity as a thing that's more beneficial to a player than rest.
Yeah, it could be that. It could be that it's not, you know, they're going to get them at most a half a game. It's better to have them kind of ticking over like a finely tuned engine than dropping in and out of the side. But maybe also he just realizes this is the situation we're in, and this is the competition where it could easily be our best shot at getting back into the Champions League. So on that basis, and he's won it three times. So on that basis, to kickstart your own career as Arsenal manager, by going far into a competition. Such as this would mean a lot, and it would buy him a lot of time if he could go into the. I'm not saying he's doing it for selfish reasons. I don't believe that for a second. But I just think you can't afford, like Wenger or other managers have done in the past. I don't think we can afford for a second to take this competition lightly.
No, I would agree with you. I do wonder if, as the season progresses, we might see our priorities change a little bit, because I do. You know, you look at the table now. And we're in fifth, we're on 15 points, same as Tottenham, 2 points behind Chelsea, we're only 4 points behind the leaders. We are, I think, in a better position than I thought we would be after the opening two games of the season. And I think, obviously, he deserves quite a bit of credit when it comes to that. I just wonder, is his approach to the early part of the Europa League group stage, is it about qualifying early and making sure that we're not having to bring key players two games far away, because we've got this game against Vorskla, which apparently this is the game where we've got a long flight, and then it's like a 3-hour or 4-hour journey by road to get to the stadium, and then I think you've got to, you know, take some donkeys or whatever it is. It's a difficult one, but those games, I think that Vorskla game comes right after the game against Liverpool at the start of November, and the following two games, we've got North London Derby and also a trip to Old Trafford. So I wonder how much strategy there is in terms of the way he's thinking about the Europa League. It's like, okay, we've got a good chance to win our first two games because they're against the two lower, or the two easiest, if you like, teams in the group. You've got a trip to Portugal to play Sporting Lisbon. So if you can qualify after four games, then you're in a really good position to leave some players behind and bring a weakened team, if you like, and make sure that you can then rest players for what are going to be difficult Premier League fixtures.
Yeah, it makes a hell of a lot of sense. And well, you know, with Christmas kind of schedule will be sort of looming, you know, in the not too distant future at that point as well. So I think you're right. You're playing Fulham on the weekend, and Fulham have not started that well. And whether he'd have done the same thing in terms of who he'd have brought with if we're playing a more formidable team on the weekend, it's a really good question. But yeah, why not get it done and dusted? But also, you know, to come on for 20, 30 minutes, I know it's a 5-hour flight there and back, but to come on for 20, 30 minutes, you know, it's not too, you know, it shouldn't be too taxing in that respect.
No, I mean, is there a possibility that we have become, in some ways, you know, we had a terrible injury record for a long time, and we were afraid that if you went to a game like this and you brought key players like Ozil, like Lacazette, that they ran the risk of getting injured. And things have improved a great deal in that regard. And also, if we were playing Champions League football, we would be playing all of our first team, more than likely, in a whatever group game it was in the Champions League against probably better opposition than Carabag. So however we view the Europa League, or our perception of the Europa League, the physical demands or the footballing demands on the players are not any different than they would be if we were in the Champions League.
Or are they? Because maybe the level's a bit lower. So mind you, you know, some of the teams we played in the Champions League group stages were, again, you know,
sure.
Didn't always feel like there was a huge lot of competition there either.
Mm.
It was when the competition really started was when we crumble straight away. But I don't know. It strikes me as being pretty wise to get, you know, to keep the momentum going for what is a very good run. And also it's better to start well than to have to kind of put all your eggs in the basket at the end of the group stage when you're suddenly realizing that it's looking a bit hairy. So, I mean, I'm all for it. And, you know, we've got a pretty big squad. We've got a squad that needs, a lot of guys need to play. So, yeah, I think it's, and also he still needs to see all these players more, you know, see who they play, you know, try them out in different positions, different formations, and in different variances. And so I'm sure he looks at it a bit like that as well, thinking I've got so much to learn here about these guys before I can really pass judgment. And this is a good opportunity to do it. So, I have no problem with taking a very strong squad there.
In general, how are you feeling about life under Unai Emery in terms of what we're doing and how we're doing it? Is it meeting expectations, or did you have any expectations? Or
I don't think I really had many expectations. I certainly didn't expect to be anywhere near the top four this year. So on that basis alone, we're hovering quite nicely in the league. I did expect us to, and probably naively, but I did expect the way we play to change a bit more fundamentally than it has. But again, 10 games in, I mean, how kind of radically can you change it? I'm not entirely sure that you can. I'm enjoying it because it's different, and I'm enjoying it because we're seeing some new players, and we're seeing some, you know, a nice little run of form. But yeah, like most people, I still wonder whether it's going to be a sort of evolution or revolution type thing, and it feels at the moment very much like the former.
I mean, it sort of feels to me like he is the kind of manager who will, what's the word I'm looking for here? I want to be careful about the way I say this. Like, I'm not sure that Unai Emery is the manager who will get us back to winning the Premier League, but I do think he's probably the kind of manager who could get us back into the top four, at which point we might find a manager, or might find it easier to attract a manager to be competitive when it comes to winning the Premier League, if indeed that is the ambition of the club, if that makes sense.
I know what you're saying is that the question still, we know that, players like managers like Guardiola and Klopp clearly at the top of their game at the moment, and they're the guys to look up to. And Emery feels like a notch down from that. But he won the he won the Ligue 1 with PSG. He's won a lot of trophies. I think his record's pretty good. So I would agree that if you were going to put money on it, you'd say the chances of winning the Premier League are pretty slim. But I wouldn't rule it out just yet. I think he did get signed up by pretty much one of the wealthiest clubs. I know it's in France where the competition is slightly less, but you know they must have seen something in him too. So I like to think that we might stand more of a chance than you think. But it's early days, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean that is the caveat that we have to look at everything.
I think it's money. Sorry to butt in. I think so much of it is not so much down to him or to someone to the man leading the club. A lot of it's to do with finances, and you know when you're able to spend 30 million quid on every single outfield player and then have two in each position, then it feels like an almost impossible job, whoever you are, to get up to that point. I really feel that. That kind of thing is so hard to compete against.
I would agree. So let me ask you this before we go. Stan Kroenke, KSE are going to be the 100% owners of this football club very soon. How do you view that when it comes to the monetary side of things? Do you expect them to put their hands in their pockets to fund the requirements that we would need to be Premier League champions again?
Not in the way that Man City do, because I don't think that, you know, they run it in a more business-like way. Mm. And you know what? It might be detrimental to us, but I would almost rather it was run a bit that way than money coming from from someone like sovereign wealth funds. And I don't know, it feels like a... it's obviously very difficult to win the Premier League, whoever you are, but to be able to throw that kind of money at it, feels, I wouldn't say cheating. It's not cheating. It feels like giving you a massive advantage though. And in a way, I think it's quite noble to try and actually run the club on the money that you earn or generate yourselves. I think we can do more there. And I think there's more deals to be done. And I think if I expect anything, I don't think they'll put money in their pocket. They've never done it to date.
No.
But I do maybe think that they'll come at the commercial side of it a bit differently, perhaps now that Gazidis is on the way out, and there'll be some changes in the boardroom level. You know, what that means in the long term is precedent with the owners doesn't really tell you that anything will change drastically, but perhaps in the commercial side of it, the business side of it, it might.
Yeah, well, that's the thing, isn't it? It's a bit like Manchester United, who are massive from a commercial point of view, but who don't have people in charge of the club who know that much about football, you know, to make the right footballing decisions. You know, that's...
Well, no, it's an interesting one, because for them, you know, the point I was making about having the money to buy every player you want kind of applies to Man U as well, but it hasn't quite worked in the same way. So obviously there's a lot of skill and long-term planning that's gone into what's happening at Man City. But I still think it's hard for a club like us, run as we are, to kind of really take them on head to head sometimes.
Mm. Were you surprised by Gazidis' decision to up sticks, given the seismic changes that he was obviously a big part of? Was it a surprise to you that, having made those changes and being the master of, or considered at least the master of the changes that took place at Arsenal, he hasn't stuck around to see how they worked out?
Yeah, yes and no. I think yes, because it felt like just as he got it how he wanted it, it would have been nice to see what happened next. But no, because for two reasons. Firstly, he's been 9 years in the job, 9 years as a sort of CEO type person. It's a hell of a long time, I think. And maybe the whole in his mind, the whole way he was planning it was to be able to do this and then say, look, I've left it in good hands, I'm off. Mm. And there's also, which I think, there's also the issue is how, now that the club is 100% Stan Kroenke's, was there always going to be a change at that point? Was, you know, is someone else coming in to do that job? And because he just knew it all along, and then, and so that's why it all came to an end like that. But I think 9 years is a long time in any job. And so in some respects, I wasn't that surprised.
Okay. All right. Well, look, we will see where this season takes us. As you say, it's still early days, so we're learning along the way. I think that's part of the fun, isn't it? That we don't really know exactly what to expect, whereas we could always predict what it was that Arsene Wenger was going to do. We're not quite sure what it is that Unai Emery is going to do, and I think that is that's part of what makes it interesting. But look, we'll catch up with you a bit later on in the season. Jim, the man from East Lower, thank you very much.
Thank you. Cheers.
Thank you very much indeed to the man from East Lower. You can find him on Twitter at East Lower. That is at East Lower, and occasionally blogging still at eastlower.co.uk. That's eastlower.co.uk. It's only when the mood takes him, though. He's not in the mood very much these days. What can I say? We all get a bit older.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design, thoughtful construction, and little details that make life in your space easier. And now they're bringing that comfort and style outside with their outdoor collection. Burrow's outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry stain-resistant foam cushions. As always, you get free shipping on every order. Get 15% off at burrow.com/acast. burrow.com/acast.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
It's a brand new year, and what better time to get going with that online store you've been thinking of? Those "I was there when Arsenal actually scored a goal" t-shirts would fly off the shelves right now. And to get yourself up and running, you need Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way through to the did we hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms, and sell more with less effort with thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 a month trial period at shopify.com/arsblog, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/arsblog now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/arsblog. Right. Raul Senyehi is our new head of football. He is going to take over the running of the football side of Arsenal when Ivan Gazidis leaves at the end of this month. So I wanted to get a bit of background on Raul and to find out what kind of a guy he is, what kind of work he did at Barcelona, where he was director of football for over 10 years. I'm joined now by Dan Hilton of the Barcelona podcast. Hi, Dan.
Hi, how are you doing today?
I'm all right. Let's talk a little bit about Raul Senyehi and where he came from. I was curious to see as to whether or not he was how steeped in Barcelona he was, and I found his LinkedIn, which hasn't been updated for quite a while. There's a very useful Raul picture of him there. But he went to a private school in Barcelona in Sarria, which is one of the most exclusive areas. It's a Jesuit school in Barcelona, so he has that in his blood.
Yeah, he was actually born in Tarrega, which is in Lleida, which is in northwest of Barcelona in Catalonia. So he is Catalonian through and through, or Catalan through and through. But it was really his move to the U.S. that kind of started the professional career that he had when he joined Nike. So it's not necessarily a footballing background that he comes from. But here in the States, if you're talking Nike in the 1990s, which is right about the time when obviously 1996 is when he hooked up with Nike, you're talking Michael Jordan, you're talking Air Jordans, especially here in the U.S. But Nike was also already working on that global brand, and that's when he goes back to Spain and becomes a managing director. So again, we're really talking the marketing side, and not as an intellectual going to a private school, but a guy who is certainly not in the traditional footballing sense, a guy coming up through that pipeline.
Yeah, he did. He did go to the Guildford College, where he was a member of the soccer team. So he's clearly somebody who enjoys football and playing football. And if you're Catalan and you're a fan of football, there's generally only one team you support, and that's Barcelona. So he went from Nike to Barcelona. He was sort of like a director of relations for a little while, and then he became the director of football there, which is a fairly important position at a club like Barcelona.
Yeah, I think the most amazing part of that whole journey, or to say that his cadre of promotions, was the fact that when he became a sporting director in 2008, I would want to always remind people that he managed to survive the presidencies of all three of Juan Laporta, Sandro Rosell, and Josep Maria Bartomeu, who's currently the president, two of which being Laporta and Rosell, that are complete opposite personalities. So he has been very fluid in his ability to kind of work with different presidents and work, obviously, under Barcelona. And yes, Arsenal, as you know, brings tons and tons of pressure, but there is this trope that the Spanish media is the most vindictive and just absurd in its amount of media coverage of, as I said, as absurdity of stories that are just completely off the rails. And we know that the British tabloids are one thing, but yeah, the Spanish media seems to add just a little bit more vindictive nature in the way they talk about both the boards and the directors, but obviously the players as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing about the Spanish media that people have to realize is that there are four daily sports newspapers which are dominated by football. You know, you've got Marca and AS, which are the Madrid-based ones, and then the Sport and El Mundo Deportivo, which are Catalan-based and friendly towards Barcelona. So there's a huge amount of media coverage that goes on. So if he's been able to traverse that particular area pretty well, then that's a good sign. One of the key deals that he was involved with during his time as director of football, and we might in a minute just talk about some of the crossover between Arsenal and Barcelona, because there have been some deals done down the years between the two clubs where I think perhaps we might have come out on top on this side of the water with the money and the players that you got, but we'll discuss that in a minute. But Neymar is a deal that was done, and he was very, very heavily involved in that. I'm not sure whether we can say all of it was particularly above board, or there were some questions certainly about how it went down, but if his job was to make sure that deal happened, he did a good job.
Yeah, it winds up being a net positive. It has been reported that he was one of the main figures in going to Brazil, meeting with Santos, and most importantly, when it comes to Neymar, meeting with his father, who does do all of the backroom dealings. And while, yes, things aren't necessarily positive in the press, and there is money that is still, we'll say, unaccounted for in the case, it winds up being, because of that treble in 2015 for Barcelona, obviously a net positive in both PR and just the way that the deal was conducted, knowing that Real Madrid was most certainly going to be doing the same thing, and they were pulling for Neymar as well. But I think while he does get so much credit for Neymar, we cannot forget that in terms of the current Barcelona and the way that they're built, he also had a major hand in bringing in Luis Suarez, Ivan Rakitic, and Marc-Andre ter Stegen as well. And unfortunately, unlike the latter three, Neymar leaving for PSG, that really wound up being a big striking point in his departure, because the club felt that he was partially to blame because of the hand that he had, because of the relationship that he had with Neymar's team, and particularly his father, that after 15 years at the club, he still didn't seem to have not only the pull to be able to keep Neymar from leaving, but he just didn't have the ability to convince Neymar's team to stay. And while obviously I would not put so much of the blame, it seemed that the player himself had already made up his mind, and it just seemed like the parties, as you remember that summer, last summer, there was that 2-3 week period where things really did transpire very, very quickly. And I find it funny that in the same way that Ronaldo's team and Ronaldo kind of parted ways with Real Madrid this summer, that when the superstar wants to go, those big moves seem to happen very, very quickly.
Yeah.
And due to Spain and obviously their buyout clauses, which is you pay the buyout clause and you're good to go, it worked very similarly with the Neymar deal. It just happened very quickly, and that was it. And I don't really know how much more he could have done.
Well, I mean, you tell me anybody who's got the ability to convince somebody that taking €200 million whatever else he's being paid by Paris Saint-Germain is a bad idea. You know, when he's got his father on one side, he's got this, he's being sold the idea of being the star at this big club. Well, suppose a club that wants to be a big club, certainly in terms of reputation or how they do business, if not necessarily in terms of, you know, what they've done in the football world down the years. That's an impossible job for anybody to turn around and convince Neymar, okay, stay at the club where Messi is always going to be the number one guy because he's simply a better player than you, always will be a better player than you. He's going to be the focus of the fans' love more than you, even if they do love you. You know, that's an impossible job. I'm curious as to what people expected from him and why he would have been in some ways a fall guy for what was just an astonishing amount of money being thrown at Neymar.
Well, the most interesting thing I think of the whole story is that the final nail in the coffin was actually pretty much completely unrelated to Neymar, if reports are accurate. And there seems to be this big rumor that has kind of been confirmed on his end that the handling and Barcelona's inability to sign Jean-Michel Seri, who you can now watch at Fulham, but at the time he was a midfielder at Nice in France in their first division in Ligue 1. And the breakdown that Barcelona seemed to want to sign the player, and the player wanted to come to Barcelona, and when things seemed to be on the finish line, you're not really sure who in the back rooms were the one who struck down the deal and said that no, but this is a player that clearly he had worked on trying to get at the club. And again, I think there's a breakdown, and we're even seeing now with another player from Ligue 1 with Barcelona in Malcolm, who came from Bordeaux, that it was a player that clearly the board wanted for XYZ reasons, and whether that might be, again, with Barcelona because he's a Brazilian and they have, again, a lot of sponsorship deals, and maybe there's rumors that they're even a commitment of a number of Brazilians on the roster and things like that. And while that's very skeptical and I find it hard to believe, there are clearly disconnects, and because Ernesto Valverde, the current manager of Barcelona, didn't necessarily want Malcolm, there is this disconnect between even different sporting directors, as we can see, and the people who will then be paying the salary at the end of the day. And I think when Arsenal kind of swept in for him, it was very easy to pry him away because it seemed like he was already on the outs already. And so it wasn't this big coup that Arsenal came in and was able to snag a sporting director at Barcelona. I think it was just very opportunistic that it wound up being a perfect time for that transition for him.
Yeah, and for Arsenal. I mean, just sort of on the transfer dealings at Barcelona, in terms of the authority or the, you know, was he the guy with the ultimate authority, the final say on whether a deal would happen, or was he somebody who was more a fixer, who could put the pieces in place, but approval had to come from above him or from the board or from the president, however that worked?
So, yeah, it seems that the president, Josep Maria Bartomeu, has that ability to give the final thumbs up or thumbs down to deals. But in July of 2017, due to restructuring of Barcelona's management system, it was Pep Segura, and in Barcelona circles, that's a big name of consternation. But when Pep Segura became the director of football in July of 2017, it did kind of restructure the power struggle there. And now here in this year of July 1st of 2018, Eric Albiol and Ramon Planes became technical director and assistant to the technical secretary, respectively. Technical director or technical secretary and assistant to the technical secretary. But nevertheless, with those two in tow as well, that restructuring kind of forced out the position that he at the moment, or that being Seniei, was occupying. And it's kind of said with Pep Segura that he has a bigger hand in La Masia, but it seems that there is this power struggle, even particularly to the kind of players and the profile that everybody at the club is kind of looking for. And I think that for Seniei, that his relationship and friendship with Ivan Gazidis, it wound up being a striking point as well for him to take that opportunity to make that jump and not say get away from Pep Segura, but it appears that, and it's kind of been a blanket statement, that it's not just him, but Segura's relationship with a lot of the people that have left the club behind the scenes in the last 6 months to a year apparently has not been very good. So basically any executive that has left in the last you know, since the last summer, it's kind of assumed that they didn't have the best relationship with Pep Segura.
Right. So he's kind of footballing napalm in a way. He's burning all before him and after him, I guess. Over the years, there have been some deals between Arsenal and Barcelona which have earned us quite a lot of money. Thierry Henry moved there. Cesc Fabregas moved there. We've done it the other way. Alexis Sanchez, a player who was, you know, a bit like Sanjehi on the way out at Barcelona because of the arrival of Luis Suarez, but Arsenal did a deal there. We've had Alex Kleb, Alexander Song. You probably don't want to hear that particular name. But, you know, Sanjehi has been in some ways connected to Arsenal. You would assume that as the director of football at Barcelona over the years, he's had good contacts with the people at Arsenal, and that is probably has gone some way to landing him the job. You know, his relationship with Ivan Gazidis down the years has been documented. So it's quite an interesting concurrence of interest there, that when his time was up at Barcelona, he's moved to a club with which he's had plenty of dealings.
Yes, certainly. And it's said that when Alex Sanchez went to Arsenal, and obviously that was not fine for Barcelona, but because of the front three, the trident of Suarez, Messi and Neymar, there really was no place for Alex Sanchez at the club. And when you look at a lot of relationships that Barcelona have with some of the other boards, like obviously a PSG or another one of the giants of world football, they're not going to do any dealings or any business with the likes of Real Madrid. Not going to do any dealings with the likes of PSG if they can help it. And even a Bayern Munich, when they were kind of sweep for Barcelona players, Barcelona fights them a little more. And then you land on a team like Arsenal that they have such a good working relationship with. And it's true that Sanjehi was really at the center of that. And even for me, from an outsider, I'm really curious seeing, after he had joined in February of 2018, working on those transfers, and obviously I'm in the States, so I follow Christian Pulisic, who's at Borussia Dortmund, where Sven Mislintat came from. And for me, looking at Arsenal structure, I think it's a really good idea to have a guy like Sanjehi, who does profile as the guy in the boardroom. He's a guy that does get things over the finish line, and it's silly. I don't want to say he's like some theatrical closer or the guy that comes in with the sunglasses indoors and takes them off to sign and finish those deals. But Mislintat, you look at the profile of the players that he has gotten for Borussia Dortmund, and they really do fit the kind of style and the kind of club that Arsenal currently is, and I really like that relationship with Sanjehi, being able to take those players that he scouted and put them over the finish line. And that's just a kind of 1-2 punch that, even for me as a Barcelona fan, I wish that there was a clear setup like that Barcelona had. Oh, they have this guy. And it really was a little bit like that with Robert Fernandez, who would be the guy to scout and would be the guy to take things where they needed to go until Pep Segura could help push things over the line as director of football. But it seems to me that Arsenal have just a much more fluid system in the way that's going to work. And again, it's a little jealous on this side.
Oh, well, look, don't worry. We've had a number of years of our transfer dealings being a little more protracted and perhaps a little less decisive than they were this summer. And if there's some evidence of what Sanjehi will bring to Arsenal, it's an efficiency in bringing players in, because we had all our incoming business done by July, really. And it's often been a case, particularly when Arsene Wenger was the manager, where deals were really protracted and went all the way to the wire and, you know, towards the transfer deadline, where Wenger thought and often did get some good business and got some bargains down the years. But there's a lot to be said for preparing your team properly and making sure that your transfer business gets done. And now that he has this extra bit of authority, which is in essence the same job that he had at Barcelona, it is going to be very interesting to see how he dovetails with Mislintat and, you know, with that authority, how he gets transfer business done in the future.
Yeah, I think one of the things that really strikes out to me in today's world of modern football when it comes to transfers, it's not even, particularly at Barcelona with La Masia, it's not even the high-profile Henrys or Alex Song or whoever it may be at the first team level that makes me nervous about transfers between, not necessarily even those two clubs, but when you even look at Man City, who keep prying away and picking off all of these different Barcelona youngsters, because obviously in England, and Arsenal is run differently, and the money that Arsenal has at their disposal is very different than Man City. I mean, obviously, Barcelona can offer on these contracts when these players turn 16, they can offer probably more money than Arsenal. We're not entirely sure. But as we've seen with youngsters in the past, and now Cesc Fabregas, that was many years ago when he made the jump, obviously. So it wasn't necessarily this global money that we're working with. But even a guy like Joel Lopez, it's a name that I want to put on people's radar. He recently went from La Masia to Arsenal's academy.
Yeah.
And it's those kind of players with now Mislintat in tow and Sanliehi having that background in Catalonia, that Man City are coming for the youth players. Man City are the one who are on the attack trying to grab Barcelona's brightest. But there is that second tier of players at Barcelona in their academy that they are producing so many top-level talents, and obviously not all of them are going to be in the Barcelona first team, and it's obviously historically difficult to get in there in the last 5, 6, 7, 8 years. Again, Sergio Roberto is probably the last guy to break through. And yet, for Arsenal, there is a class that could also be pried away with the money and Premier League money that Arsenal has. So my biggest worry isn't even Barcelona players getting whisked away to North London. My worry is when Sanliehi comes potentially calling for guys who are 15, 16 years old, or just about to be 16, and he says, hey, we've got some Premier League minutes for you over here, and we've got a pretty good Premier League contract and a salary to boot for you over here if you don't think you're going to make it at Barcelona. So I think he could have a role in terms of that as well.
Okay, well, look, personally, obviously, I hope we do steal all of your best players, particularly the young ones, but it's unlikely to happen quite as in that much depth. But look, it's been a pleasure to talk to you, and thank you for giving me your time. Just tell people where they can listen to your podcast. If they're looking for a Barcelona podcast, where would they get it?
Well, it's the simplest thing, as you just said. It's called the Barcelona Podcast. So you basically type in Barcelona Podcast and anywhere, iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher. We're also on the website on barcelblog.com. You go there and we have a post that's directly related to, so you can watch it, or not watch it, but you can listen to it right on your desktop as well. And so it's basically anywhere where you'd listen to a podcast. And again, our website also is barcelblog.com. So we've got some pretty cool stuff there. If you're interested in the youth players or even the younger stuff, we do a Friday weekly La Masia profile where we talk about a player, but we also have, again, their match reviews, different top fives, so your top five stories of the day. And we do a lot of stuff over there, obviously related to and dedicated to Barcelona. So as I know, in the United States, you have a lot of people who are very fluid and they support multiple clubs. And again, if you're someone like me who absolutely love Thierry Henry, I've got a soft place in my heart for basically any club that he suited up for. And what a fantastic player. And it was a pleasure coming on to the show. Thanks so much for having me.
My pleasure. I like the fact that you've got a specific post so we can see which young players we're going to steal from you. This is great. I'm going to go check that out.
You're chatting.
Dan, thanks a million.
Thanks.
Thank you very much indeed to Dan. Some insight and background into Raul Sanliehi there, and he is going to be the man who is driving the football side of Arsenal for the weeks, months, and maybe years to come when Ivan Gazidis goes. The questions that occur to you, of course, is how much authority will he have? How much freedom will he have? What are the restrictions that he's going to have to work with? What are the stated ambitions of KSE and the Cronkies? Are they going to say one thing to him and not deliver the things that he needs to make that happen? He's obviously going to have a remit. Get us into the top four. Make us competitive. Make us competitive in Europe. Make us competitive in the Premier League. It's all well and good to say those things, and it's actually quite easy to say those things. But unless you give people the resources and the backing and the support to make them happen, it's going to be very difficult for him and for everybody on the football side of Arsenal to get back to where we would all like us to get back to, which is, you know, on top, looking down, going, yep, we're the champions. So it's going to be interesting over the coming months and weeks and years to see how it all develops. He is, by all accounts, a very smart, intelligent guy, and hopefully he can convince Cronkies that this is a club worth investing time and money into, because the rewards of that would be fantastic for them, Because if we're successful, we're going to make more money. The value of their asset, the value of their investment increases. Whether they want to sell it or whether they want to keep it, we will generate more revenue if we are more successful. So I hope that happens. We have got Fulham on Sunday at midday. Not a great preview, to be honest. We're going to see some changes, obviously, from the team that played against Carabag on Thursday night. Hopefully the travel and the distance between the two fixtures doesn't have too negative an impact. We've won 8 in a row. It would be very good to make that 9 in a row. We'll find out on Sunday. We'll keep fingers crossed for that. James and I will be here on Monday or maybe Sunday evening. I don't know yet, with an Arscast Extra. We'll look back on that particular game. Just to remind you that we do have some excellent stuff on our Patreon site. If you like video games and if you like football, we have a great interview for you with Danny O'Dwyer, who is the guy behind NoClip. They make documentaries about video games, but we chat about video games and we chat about football. We chat about Arsenal. If that floats your boat, check it out. patreon.com/arsblog. It is €5 a month plus VAT if you're in the EU. If you're not in the EU, you do not have to pay any VAT. But that's all it costs. You get access to all the content that we have on our Patreon site. There's loads of stuff, a great Champions League special, articles, other history podcasts. It's all there for you for just €5 a month. Check it out. patreon.com/arsblog. Gonna leave it there because I can feel a bit of a tickle in my throat. I think my voice is going, so I better save it for the weekend and podcast to come. Thanks as ever for listening. Really appreciate it. We'll catch you on the next one. Until then, cheers. Bye-bye.
Hi, I'm Stuart Gale. And I'm Tony Robson. Join us for a brand new series of Cunt Pundits. Every time there's an Arsenal game, we'll give you interminable shite, hapless bollocks, unceasing negativity, wearisome nonsense, ill-informed garbage, sustained gobbledygook, never-ending twaddle, incessant drivel, continual hogwash, endless balderdash, and constant claptrap. If you want to watch Arsenal and have your IQ lowered by up to 30 points in less than 90 minutes, check out the brand new series of Cunt Pundits.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.